this week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
If my ancestors, as slaves, can lead the greatest general strike in the history of this country, taking it to the ultra-rich and big corporations, we can do the same today.
Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson calls for a national general strike against Trump's fascist crackdown as ICE and the military unleash unprecedented raids terrorizing immigrant communities.
We must have a political organization and a political party that represents the interests of working class people. The Democratic Party will never solve our problems.
In Los Angeles, where ICE, the National Guard, and the Marines have intensified attacks on immigrant communities, Roofers Local 36 business manager Cliff Smith speaks about the call for a national general strike, the rise of fascism, and how working people can fight back.
You can still stall a machine by pulling out a single lug nut. And it's sad to say this, but businesses rely on cheap immigrant labor. I'm sorry. If I'm the one that says it, this is the hill I'll plant my flag on.
In part two of an interview we aired last week, Memphis-based immigration lawyer Andrew Rankin discusses DACA, TPS, and other issues surrounding the Trump government's assault on immigrant workers. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Polina Vasilyev. The Trump administration has inspired some of the largest mass demonstrations in the history of the United States. Crowds have been especially large and angry in Chicago, where ICE and the military have launched massive attacks on immigrants and even landed a Black Hawk helicopter on a building to terrorize an entire community. At the No Kings rally on October 18th, Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson said that people of the United States are facing a fascist government and that ICE is the personal fascist gang of President Trump. He called for a national general strike against the Trump government to stop these attacks.
Donald Trump is using ICE as his private militarized occupying force. The only other entities that are funded greater than ICE are the United States military and China's military. But we are saying emphatically clear, we do not want troops in our city. We will not allow our cities to be occupied. Now here's the last and final point. We have to be absolutely clear of not just what we're fighting for, but what we are looking to tear down. Donald Trump just shifted the largest concentration of upward wealth into the hands of the ultra-rich and large corporations in the history of this country. This is a fight for working people across this country and across this globe to stand up to billionaires in the interest of corporations. Now, there are some billionaires and corporate leaders that want us to have sympathy for them, and they have just received the greatest tax cuts at the expense of health care and housing and education and transportation and good-paying jobs. So here's what we need to do in this moment. If my ancestors, as slaves, can lead the greatest general strike in the history of this country, taking it to the ultra-rich and big corporations, we can do the same today. I'm calling on Black people, white people, brown people, Asian people, immigrants, gay people from around this country to stand up against tyranny and to send a clear message to the ultra-rich and big corporations. We are going to make them pay their fair share and taxes democracy will live on because of this generation.
That was Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson calling for a national general strike against Trump and the billionaires who support him. Los Angeles has faced massive attacks by ICE agents and the National Guard and U.S. Marines. Los Angeles Roofers Local 36 business manager Cliff Smith spoke to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer about Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson's call for a national general strike.
Today in Chicago, Brandon Johnson, the mayor of Chicago, actually called for a national general strike against the fascist attacks in Chicago. Is this a sign that things are beginning to change, that people realize that there has to be mass action of the working class to deal with this government, these fascist attacks?
Well, it can only be seen as a sign for the mayor of the third largest city in the country that's under a direct threat from not just Trump's ICE secret police agents, but the military. For him to call for a nationwide general strike puts him at the front of the entire social movement, puts him in front of the labor movement, it puts him in front of any large-scale mass organization. And, you know, credit where it's due. We salute Mayor Johnson for putting forward this call today.
And there was a rally today in Los Angeles. What happened there? Los Angeles, as well, has been under attack by these gangs terrorizing the immigrants, raiding neighborhoods, and threatening people.
It was a spirited rally. You know, it had a mass turnout. It has its limitations, you know, due to the leadership and the kind of vague demands. But it's important that people stand up and come out into the streets and protest. So, you know, in general, it's a statement against Trump's advances toward fascism. It's a statement toward the defense of democracy, and you know, it needs to be supported.
And the issue of healthcare in California, where you're from, I'm from as well, 3.4 million people will lose their Medicaid. And nationally, 500,000 healthcare workers are going to lose their jobs as a result of these cutbacks. It seems like for working people in this country, this is going to be a life and death struggle, whether or not they even get healthcare.
Well, right. And so, you know, we see that this shutdown of the federal government, which is initiated by the Republican administration who controls every branch, it's a positive thing that the Democrats are drawing the line to not cave in as they did in March. You know, Democratic Party leaders like Chuck Schumer, they crossed the line and gave in earlier this year. And it's because of the pressure from the working class, from the masses, from the rank and file average working people, that even the top levels of the Democratic Party recognizes that it's time to draw a hard line against Trump. And the funding for the healthcare subsidies is one of the pivotal conflicts in that struggle.
And yet in California, where the Democrats have a majority in the legislature, a supermajority, you have a Democratic governor. While they're pushing 50, Prop 50, there are no demands for the legislature to tax the billionaires in California to make them pay for healthcare, education, housing, and the benefits they're going to get from Trump's tax cuts to going to the wealthy in this country. Couldn't the Democrats do that if they really represented working people?
Sure. And of course they don't. And, you know, these are the hypocrisies and failures of the Democratic Party, which, you know, as you mentioned earlier, why we must build political organization, a political party that represents the interests of working class people, that can fight for a people's democracy and not a paper democracy. You know, the Democratic Party is compromised. It's completely sold out and corrupted. But to the extent that it will take on any fight against fascism, you know, we need to make sure that fascism is always isolated.
And has there been a discussion of fascism? Because although Brandon Johnson and my union, the CWA, they talk about authoritarianism and fascism, there doesn't seem to be any real discussion, education in the labor movement about what fascism is.
I would say that there's no discussion about it. The kind of think tank positions of the labor movement, they use the term that you mentioned, authoritarianism, which I think is vague, it's abstract, and it's malleable. It can be used against the labor movement. The argument in the Janus case of public employee unions was that unions are authoritarian by demanding that the workers have to be part of the union and have to have their dues deducted from their paychecks. The Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, was accused of being authoritarian. The investigations and impeachments of Donald Trump were accused of being authoritarian overreach. So, you know, that's a kind of a favorite accusation by the far right, by the groups like the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys, that Joe Biden, that Kamala Harris, that the AFL-CIO, that these are authoritarian organizations. And so, you know, ultimately the term really means anything that anybody wants it to mean. And so it's important that we talk about fascism because it has a historical and material scientific definition of the ultimate extension of capitalism in its failure, the absolute direct rule of force by terror of the capitalist ruling class, whereas authoritarianism just means, you know, we don't like authority, which, you know, can be used by anybody.
And is that an issue really in this No King's Day? Because even if you get rid of Trump, don't you still have a system of capitalism and techno-fascism and people who really want to rule without any constitution, without any democratic rights?
Clearly. And, you know, it could be worse than even Trump. So, you know, Trump as an individual person is not, you know, the absolute cause of the circumstances that we're in, the conditions we're in. It's the failures of the crisis of the capitalist system that, you know, they're trying to resolve their internal contradictions on the backs of working people. And the only way that they can do that is by direct force. The working people are not going to support austerity. We're not going to support trillions of dollars of giveaways to the rich people, to the ruling class. We're not going to support cutting our medical coverage, our food assistance for poor people. We're not going to support cuts to infrastructure projects and investment that is desperately needed in this country. And so Trump and his MAGA Republicans and the people that finance that movement, they have to resort to the direct rule of force. And unfortunately, the labor movement is so compromised and conciliatory toward capitalists and capitalism that they won't talk about fascism. They just use these kind of vague and abstract terms like authoritarianism, which, again, you know, will be thrown back in their faces.
And the issue of the genocide, U.S. supported genocide, support of Israel and what's going on in Gaza and the West Bank, it seems like the AFL-CIO has been completely silent. They won't even say it's a genocide. Has there been debate in the labor movement in Los Angeles about taking action against the genocide, about a labor blockade? The Palestinian unions have called for a labor blockade. Unions in Europe and Italy, the dock workers and others are taking action. It seems like American workers should be taking similar action.
There's been no meaningful deliberation in the labor movement about standing up for the rights of the Palestinian people to self-determination, to the end of Zionist imperialism. You know, the California Labor Federation passed a paper resolution supporting Palestinian people, but as far as taking matters into our own hands as labor, there's absolutely no conversation in that regard. And, you know, shame on the labor movement, shame on the AFL-CIO.
And there's also the danger of an imminent invasion of Venezuela. And as you know, the AFL-CIO Solidarity Center has been involved in supporting attempted coups in Venezuela. The Solidarity Center was getting $70 million a year from the National Endowment for Democracy, USAID. I mean, this whole issue of the international role of the AFL-CIO, is that important for workers to understand in this struggle to defend, for example, Venezuela and oppose support for U.S. military interventions?
Well, you know, and this is, again, goes to the heart of the compromise position of the AFL-CIO, is that it claims to support workers, but only the workers that it prefers to support at the expense of the rest of the world's working class. And, you know, workers are workers wherever we are, wherever we come from. Workers in Venezuela have the same interests as workers in Los Angeles or in Chicago or anywhere else in the United States. And if the AFL-CIO is going to even pretend to be a voice for working people, it has to support the interests of working people internationally. And of course, as you're saying, it has taken the opposite positions. It has taken sides with the ruling class of imperialism against working people in countries like Venezuela and elsewhere.
And another issue facing workers, particularly in port cities like Los Angeles, is the trade war and the growing tariffs. Has that affected the workers in Los Angeles? And what are the unions doing about this trade war? Because it seems like it's hurting working people on all sides of the border, Mexico, Canada, China, blaming China for the trade war. I mean, it seems like this escalating trade war could lead to a depression.
Well, and that's very possible. And it could happen sooner than I think the AFL-CIO wants to imagine. There's been, you know, some paper discussion, some social media statements, but nothing along the lines of educating rank and file workers, of trying to prepare for mobilization to stand up against these international economic policies based on exploitation, based on trying to export the problems of the United States economy onto other countries, which falls onto the shoulders of working people in those countries. The AFL-CIO has been entirely complicit with the ruling class in the United States in international affairs.
And Chris Smalls has called, along with other unions, including the San Diego Labor Council and some SEIU locals, for a protest at the AFL-CIO on October the 24th, demanding that the AFL-CIO support a labor blockade of Israel and also oppose the genocide. There's going to be an action in San Francisco, the San Francisco Labor Council. What do you think about taking action, demanding action by the unions, for the unions to really take a stand on these issues?
Well, you know, ultimately, it's going to fall into the hands of rank and file workers, union members, to push the leadership or to push the leadership aside. I'm not aware of the announcement for a specific date and a specific action that you mentioned. I'd be happy to learn about it. I think I heard you say the San Diego Labor Federation is supporting,
is endorsing it. Yes.
I would like to see that.
Okay. And you have for a long time been talking about a workers' party, a labor party. What would a workers' party do at this point in this kind of struggle, if there was one?
Well, I mean, the first thing is the average rank and file workers, both in the labor movement and the majority of workers, which are not represented by a labor union, need to be educated and organized. The only way we're going to solve the problems that we're facing, and you know, we can see that these problems are only going to be exacerbated and get worse in the near future even, is that workers, as you're saying, need to be able to take direct action, need to be able to seize hold of pressure points in the economy, the ports being one of those, shipping being one of those. And there's no organization that's in place to be able to provide that leadership, to provide that education and mobilization. We must have a political organization and a political party that represents the interests of working class people. The Democratic Party will never solve our problems.
That was Los Angeles Roofers Local 36 business manager Cliff Smith talking about No King's protests in Los Angeles and the call for a nationwide general strike, genocide, and U.S. wars abroad. He was interviewed by Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer. That was Thievery Corporation, El Pueblo Unido. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Paulina Vasiliev. Thousands of people rallied in Los Angeles on No King's Day and spoke out. KPFK's Peter Ross spoke to some of the trade unionists about why they were there.
David Green, DAVIDGREEN, President Executive Director of SEIU Local 721. It's a beautiful day in Los Angeles. I have the honor of representing 100,000 public sector employees, public sector workers. We're frontline workers. We're a social justice organization. So it's important for us to be here today to kind of push back about what's happening at the federal, the state, even the local level. Immigration raids, cuts to Medi-Cal and Medicare, blatant violations of the Constitution in the United States. And, you know, our folks are public sector workers, we're frontline workers, and we're seeing the effects of what something like the government shutdown has on the most vulnerable citizens of Los Angeles, who we serve every single day, whether you're an eligibility worker, social worker, emergency room nurse. We're here today to kind of send a message that we're unified. We're here as community organizations, faith-based groups, and obviously labor unions, kind of lead the charge to push back about these blatant violations of the Constitution, blatant violations of free speech, and you just we're here in support and solidarity of these other groups today to have, you know, let Los Angeles, let the country know that we're not backing down, we're not going back. Labor organizations are social justice organizations. We don't just serve the community, we are the community. So we see the effects as citizens, as the people we serve on every single level. And, you know, throughout history, labor organizations, working people have led the charge towards social justice. So that's why SAU721 is here today. It's become deeply personal because whether it's union presidents or the people we serve or members of the community, most vulnerable citizens, we see them being attacked, arrested, having their health care taken away, afraid to go to school, afraid to seek medical services, and that hurts the community. So that's why this is the moment for the labor movement. This is the moment for SAU721, along with our brothers, sisters, and siblings, to step up and take action. That's what today's about. We're hoping you see how many people there is here today, the momentum, the energy to remain unified. We're out there telling people to vote yes on Prop 50. Because what's happening in the Congress, you see the byproducts of it now. We're strongly supporting Yes on Prop 50 campaign. We're encouraging people to vote, to use their voice, to hold elected officials accountable for the things that they do, and to support the public, to support public sector unions, to support their communities.
Leslie Littman, California Teachers Association, and the Heart District Teachers Association. For educators, what's happening at the federal level in terms of cuts to the Department of Education, to funding for our schools, for special needs, for meals, for all of that, plus then all of the other issues that are impacting our students and their families. We just can't have it. Like, we need a government that actually works for the people and not billionaires. The ICE raids are impacting our students and their families. Kids are afraid to come to school because they're not sure if a family member will be home when they get there. And that's, you know, disconcerting at the low end, and it's truly frightening for many. And the fact is that when a family member gets taken by ICE, that also has a huge impact on them economically. Help pay the bills, help make ends meet, help with just what you need a family member to be doing. And it's all just ridiculous and absurd. And we don't need a government that goes and attacks people. Everybody's here trying to make a living wage and build a better country. ICE and these raids are not helping with that. And then in regards to attacks on our people, you know, we're teaching our students, and, you know, we're standing up for them and their education. They've got one chance to get an education. And we're the ones that are going to stand up and fight for the schools that they deserve and that they need, an education that they need, that also help our country and our economy. And, you know, and to attack us for defending what we should all be fully funding and supporting is absurd in this day and age. And so folks who are willing to speak up out and speak out against what is happening here should be allowed to do it. It's a foundation of our country. It's a foundation, you know, that's what we fought for however many years ago. First Amendment, you know, and you know, we all became teachers to make a difference. This is the way we do it. Here at this moment, labor is working to pass Prop 50. That, you know, we didn't want to be in this position. Nobody wants to be running a special election in an off year. But the reality is that we are a state that has elected leaders and Congress who voted against their constituents, who actually we had meetings with them and lied to us and said we wouldn't do that. And then they flat out went and did it. Cut benefits to health care, all of those things. And so, you know, we have a system in place to, you know, independent body to redraw the lines after every census, but game's changing. And this is the way we fight it. At this moment in time, it's a temporary solution. We go back to it after the next census. But we're about expanding the rights of people and making lives better. And all of the other gerrymandering in the other states is out to silence BIPOC candidates, BIPOC voters, and work against what's the best for the public.
My name is Chris Winnell, and my union is UTLA. United Teachers Los Angeles. I'm going to tell you what, this is my own opinion, but this is where, this is like a signal of how we can withhold our labor in a massive national manner, you know, in an action that really like hits every level of worker, not one union against the other. And what's happening right now, the government is shut down too. So that in itself, how the Democrats are withholding their labor in a way, or, you know, holding a position, you know, that's a type of strike too. So, but problem with, you don't see the corporate Democrats linking up with the labor-centered, worker justice-centered Democrats. You know what I mean? Which is just weird, because once you get in with it and you have that type of direct action democratic movement in the streets and within the offices of all levels of government, you guys got to link up because the Republicans are already linked up. So, well, there's a lot of cohesion right now among the workers across the nation. So once every level of worker understands that they have rights and they can actually do something to assert those rights by banding together, it's just a matter of when and where. And there's plans to do that. That's why you see a coalition of labor unions working in harmony, right? We're actually just working with each other to assert our own rights and to really get rights that some people have now. They need wage increases. There's a lot of wage theft, exploitation going on, and the government shouldn't be, you know, facilitating that. So no kings allowed.
Those were trade unionists who spoke out in Los Angeles during the No Kings Day, interviewed by KPFK's Peter Ross.
My fellow Americans, this is Liberation Day, waiting for a long time. April 2nd, 2025 will forever be remembered as the day American industry was reborn, the America's destiny was reclaimed, and that we began to make America wealthy.
That's what he's talking about. He ain't talking to you.
Wealthy, good and wealthy.
He talks to the elite class.
For decades, our country has been looted, pillaged, raped,
and plundered by nations near and far, both friend and foe alike. American workers, auto workers, farmers, and skilled craftsmen. We have a lot of fellow Americans. This is Liberation Day. Waiting for a long time.
Yeah, for the elite, for the rich, for the poor.
April 2nd, 2025.
They want to destroy the poor. Time to fight back, people. Let's get it.
Let's talk about society's conflict approach. Systematic rule keeping most people broke.
Yes, sir.
Pay attention, structural functionalism. Speak your real life through the form of rhythm. Criticize, I'm a Marxist analysis. Bars is contraband, God give the talent. MCs get ate and tossed like a salad. Rebel servant, voice of the masses. You walk around half dead, look at Joe Biden. Another puppet for the bourgeois titans. They exploit labor. Rugged and raw, finance the police, corporate state law, privatized prisons, neo-slave labor, the government sold out doing many favors, demonize the poor and mental health behaviors, repent and have love for your neighbor, revolution's not a gimmick, it's a lifestyle, willing to die for the people like Chairman Mao.
That was Conflict Approach by Apostle B.A. Abad and Creature K. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Paulina Vasiliev. In this next segment, Memphis-based immigration attorney Andrew Rankin speaks to Pacifica's Thomas O'Rourke about the legality of ICE tactics in the Trump era, DACA and TPS immigration laws, and more. This is the second part of an interview that first aired on last week's October 13th show.
In the case of children caught up in this, be they children born in the U.S. and thus protected as U.S. citizens from deportation, or young people previously given DACA protections that are now being withdrawn. What are the rights of these children? Who is seeing to it that they are observed? And what is the Flores settlement regarding migrant children? What is it and how does it apply?
Yeah, so DACA, it's, as we know, the DA in DACA is deferred action, which is the best way I can describe it for non-lawyers would be an act of forbearance or administrative grace in taking an otherwise permissible enforcement action. If you are unlawfully present, There is a federal law that says that individual can be placed in front of an immigration judge for possible removal from the country. DACA, the deferred action, it defers that action that would otherwise be permissible. But if it can be taken, if it can be given to a non-citizen as an act of administrative grace, it can be taken away in their sole discretion. And there haven't been a lot of DACA arrests, not thousands and thousands, but there have been several hundred where the government has detained and put into removal proceedings active DACA holders. And presumably, what would happen there is DHS would seek to unwind that particular person's protections in case they are unsuccessful in their deportation defense. There'd be nothing stopping them from removing the person. So that's sort of a cabined explanation on DACA. As far as what happens to them, so what would happen is if they're adults, Thomas, then they're going to go into the regular adult immigration detention system. Even if they came as children, it's an important thing to remember. Even if they came as a 3-month-old baby, if they're arrested at age 19 for whatever, then they're going to go into the regular adult system. Now, if they are minors, I have not heard of anybody being detained in that context. I'm not saying I know every single arrest that's ever happened since January 20th, but I like to think I'm pretty plugged in. I haven't heard of any under 18-year-old getting arrested. But if that were to happen, then the Flores settlement would come in to ensure that they are held in the, here it comes, least restrictive setting. That's what the Flores consent decree is all about, is to ensure that children, if they must be detained, are held in the least restrictive arrangement for the shortest amount of time. So if these arrests were to happen, obviously the immigration attorney defending that non-citizen would need to be acutely aware of making sure the government complies with the FSA, the Flores Settlement Agreement. And if that isn't being followed, then to contact the district court and class counsel for further litigation, because they'll need to be involved in forcing the government to comply.
Yeah, I read that there was a standard of a 20-day maximum of being held for these kids. But of course, the Trump administration is trying to undermine or, rewrite this consent decree. Yeah,
that is correct. Yeah. Okay. So it's that, and that even further is why, you know, when you if there's anybody out there that's going to be representing a minor DACA non-citizen who's arrested for XYZ, you need to be counting the days. Luckily, again, I haven't had any of those cases. I haven't heard any of them. And I want to believe that there aren't that many that do exist. But for the ones that do, make sure Flores is at the forefront of your mind if ICE chooses to detain. Because they can also just decide to release on some sort of supervision or check-in requirement instead of detention. But if they do detain, Flores needs to be at the front row of your mind.
Okay. But I did want to mention, and I just read about it, a recent class action lawsuit was filed here in district federal court in D.C. With a lead plaintiff of a man named Jose Escobar Molina, 47-year-old Salvadoran man, who's been here since 2001 under temporary protected status. He was arrested on the street and, you know, just sort of when they discover after the fact things that they probably should have known beforehand to legally arrest him, how does that, is there any consequence to federal law enforcement? And by the way, I wanted to ask, are these ICE people and law enforcement, they're generally immune from any wrongdoing or illegal arrests they might make, are they not? By the
Yeah,
fact that,
so
go ahead.
yeah, so I would say the taking the issues as they arose in your question, the first one is detention. There is a federal statute that discusses how and if and when a TPS recipient can be detained. Generally, they can't be. So when they go after somebody who's on TPS and they try to detain them, they really need to be careful because there's a statute, Section 244 of the Immigration and Nationality Act, that discusses temporary protected status. And just by the fact that they're undocumented is not enough to detain them if they're maintaining active TPS. So that's one thing. And they need to keep that in mind. Number two, it is actually possible to maintain TPS and still go through removal proceedings. And here is where I will draw a difference between DACA and TPS. Now, what does that mean? As I mentioned a few minutes ago, Thomas, deferred action is administrative grace. TPS is a federally enacted statute. It cannot be withdrawn because today is Thursday. No, sir. It cannot be. It has to be formally rescinded on notice with a chance to rebut. It can't just be taken away because they've grabbed this gentleman on the street, despite what the government may try to convince others that it can do that. It can. So, but if they're put into proceedings, they can actually go through the entire case. It's just that the government cannot effect any removal order while TPS is being maintained. But there's actually binding immigration precedent from the Board of Immigration Appeals, which is our intermediate appellate body, that has said that there's nothing stopping ICE from going through removal proceedings with a non-citizen who's maintaining TPS. It's just that ICE cannot effect that removal order, should an order happen, until that person's TPS is over. So that would be something that everyone should know about TPS, because when it's a federal statute, the federal law provides what ICE can and cannot do.
It's a clear distinction, and I'm glad I asked the question. When did TPS arise as a, when was it enacted?
So that was so if it was 2001, I've done enough of these cases to know that that was El Salvador. 2001 would have been, I believe it was a series of earthquakes, because Honduras was in 1998 and there was a hurricane. I think it was Hurricane Mitch. And then in 2001, I think there were some weather disasters in El Salvador and a series of earthquakes, and it's been renewed ever since. And then the first Trump administration tried to terminate it. That didn't work out. It's back on until next year. But as a foreshadow, you've seen, I know you've seen it, Thomas, and I know I've seen it, the government has been terminating TPS designations left, right, and center like hotcakes. So folks from El Salvador might want to, this isn't a plug for the Law Office of Andrew Rankin, but it is a point to all the viewers that if you've got El Salvadoran folks who are on TPS, you might want to have them consult with counsel, because there's no reason to think TPS is going to be extended. Honduras was just terminated last month after 26 years, and litigation is ongoing, but nevertheless, it's still been terminated. And there's no reason to think El Salvador won't go the same way. So keep that in mind to all the people out there.
Yeah. So TPS is part of the original Immigration and Migration Act, right? The 1952 law.
No. It's much more recent. It was early 90s that it was
Okay.
put into the immigration laws, and the provisions of the law have been redesignated a couple of times, renumbered, redesignated, especially with the 1996 major immigration legislation signed by President Clinton. Immigration practitioners call that IIRA IRA, but it's the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act of 1996 that did a whole big renumbering of the system. But as far as TPS being a thing that you could call, that you can get protections from, we're looking at 1990. So that's been, what is that, 30, 35 years, you know, well over three decades now. And different countries have been designated by different secretaries of Homeland Security over the decades because of war, famine, civil unrest, economic infrastructure collapse, hurricanes, wildfires, earthquakes, and the like. Originally, the Immigration Department was under the Justice Department, the Immigration Bureau branch. So it was the Attorney General. It was the Attorney General and who ultimately made the call. But sure, there were some other partners involved, both at the federal level and in the particular country that was under consideration. But when the Homeland Security Act was signed in the aftermath after 9/11, the functions were split between the Justice Department and then the newly created Department of Homeland Security. So now it's sort of a joint effort. It's actually the Secretary of Homeland Security, Thomas, that makes the call. Somebody has to be the one to sign it. Who puts the signature? It's the DHS secretary. In this case, it's Kristi Noem. In the past, it was Ali Mayorkas and others, Janet Reno, Napolitano, et cetera. Yeah. I think Elaine Duke did a couple of them when she was Trump 1.0's DHS secretary, and there were others. So they're supposed to have consultation with federal and local partners who assess conditions on the ground. Now, this could come about by a push from the public. Please designate, Thomas, that's the word, designate. Please designate this country for TPS. Please designate Afghanistan after we pulled out of Afghanistan in 2021. Please designate it. Now, the government can do it on its own, but sometimes it comes from a push from the public. Please designate this country for TPS. And so then the government has to figure out, okay, what does the designation look like? And they've got three choices. They can go 6 months, 12 months, or 18 months. That's the max. 18 months is the max they can designate at any one time. And then they have to publish a designation document in the Federal Register, which is, of course, available to all the listeners out there. You can download a copy and get all the publications that the federal government makes. So they would make a publication in the Federal Register that sets out the registration period and the start and end dates for the designation. And then in advance of the end of that designation, they have to reassess to determine whether modification, extension, or termination is warranted.
What are the near-term and medium-term consequences for American workers of this chauvinist campaign to terrorize a distinct sector of the working class by declaring them all illegals? Also, have you seen any signs of effective resistance to ICE and the DHS campaign, say among unions, neighborhood or community groups, legal forces? And let me combine that with this question. Why do you think so few politicians or pundits are demanding amnesty for what is plainly a misdemeanor criminal act of crossing the border without permission or overstaying illegal permission to be temporarily in this country as a tourist, student, etc.? Why is there no call for amnesty? And what sort of resistance do you see within the working class, given the fact that this campaign is so squarely aimed at workers of all stripes, but with the express purpose of picking off what is perceived to be, you know, some of the most vulnerable?
Yeah, so we're looking at, it's going to be higher prices. And I always give this long view answer when people ask this question, whether I'm on with a distinguished person like yourself or just in just my local podcast, is the Mississippi River is a very long river, but it starts up in Minnesota in some tiny, tiny lake or pool. But eventually that droplet of water will make it to the Gulf of Mexico. It may take a while to get there, but that water will eventually spill in to the Gulf. So just because you haven't seen it doesn't mean you won't see it. And the American machine is very, very large. It has a lot of parts. It turns slowly. But you can still stall a machine by pulling out a single lug nut. So when you, and it's sad to say this, but businesses rely on cheap immigrant labor. I'm sorry. If I'm the one that says it, this is the hill I'll plant my flag on. Anybody who's opposed to this is treading on hypocritical grounds, Thomas, because think about it. Who cuts your yard? Who put the roof on your house? Who laid the foundation for your house? My guess is, in the vast majority of circumstances, it's some sort of an immigrant, and probably an undocumented immigrant. So will there be exceptions? Of course. I'm not speaking in categorical terms, but for people who are up in arms and crying about everybody's illegal and open borders, if you've had an undocumented person clean your house or put the roof on your house or fix the roof on your house or repair your HVAC or cut your grass or tend to your flowers in your garden, then you have accepted what is going on. And you are at best a hypocrite. You want it your way in your own home, but it's a problem when you step outside of it. Can't really square that. So you're going to start feeling price increases, because when you remove that cheap immigrant labor, then you're going to get Tom, Dick, and Harry, American worker, who's going to say, I want $24.50 an hour. Business says, okay, sure. Then we have to raise the prices to the customer. When Thomas goes to eat dinner at the restaurant, he sees that steak he likes that used to be $75 is now $119. So I think that's going to be what you are going to see. And also a potential, depending on the business, a certain reduction in services. If they can't find adequate staff, then they'll just have to cut back on the services they can provide to the public. So that's that issue. As far as why no amnesty, it's a great question, and I'm going to answer it in the following way. There's not going to be a push for that unless the politicians feel that that would solve the problem of immigration. We saw it in the 80s with multiple amnesty programs. I was a little tyke, but you were not, Thomas. You remember.
Yeah.
So we had two separate amnesties, three really. We had two directed at farm workers. You might remember that, the SAW program, special agricultural workers. And then you had the general amnesty for just your regular old undocumented folk. But
there is some popularity for this campaign among elements of the working class for various reasons, not realizing, I would proffer, that they as a class are the ultimate target, and that this picking off of, like I said, the most vulnerable is eventually going to snowball on them or ricochet back on them. And I include, for example, the generalized fear that is inculcated in people when they see, you know, masked soldiers rappelling out of a helicopter and storming and, you know, knocking on doors of an apartment building and, you know, demanding entrance and things like that. So, I mean, it's a generalized fear that they're inculcating. And
I think that that's the whole point. And I think that, you know, as far as, you know, it's interesting, you know, who criticizes. And, you know, when we have academic debates and, you know, professional discussions, you know, I'm very inquisitive. I've actually had discussions with a lot of these people. And when I probe their logic, it just doesn't hold, or it holds up only for the people. Now, here's the only subset it can hold up for. It's going to be the people who never, ever violated the law. I'm sorry. I will call out hypocrisy where I see it, Thomas. I don't care. If I'm a hypocrite, I'll call on myself if I act that way. But I'm sorry. If you go through the process you at one point were undocumented or you overstayed your visa, and then you get papers, you turn around and criticize the people that are in the position that you used to be in. I'm sorry, I dismiss those individuals out of hand. I don't care if they've gone on to be the CEO of Global Everything and Mega Steel. I don't care if you go through the process, come out clean on the other side, and then turn your back on the people who are now suffering just because you're no longer suffering. You've lost all credibility, at least with me, because none of the points you make are sincere to any degree. Now, for the people who say, well, I did it the legal way. I waited my 20 years in the Philippines to get my sibling visa, and I didn't violate one law. To those people, I would say you're rare. Some people can't wait. Some people don't have bread to eat. Some people don't have a home and they're sleeping on the street or in a ditch. Or some people are sick or they're dying and they can't get medical care in their country. I mean, it's like you said, it's a misdemeanor. If we're going to debate that this is the worst thing a human being can do, we're in trouble as a country right now. The game is already over. So we can debate levels of felony, misdemeanor. At the end of the day, the person crossed a line they shouldn't have crossed. If they're doing everything else right, we can hold them accountable relative to what they've done instead of making them pariah, which is what these individuals who have a problem with it are essentially saying. And they're making this mountain out of the tiniest molehill. And so I think that's, you know, I'm not too bothered by those people because most of them are just trying to talk out of both sides of their backside. And so there's only a few small subset of people that actually have legitimate points there. But as far as the fear campaign, I mean, that is the entire point. I mean, I've seen immigration officers and I'm just under 6'1". I'm well built. I work out and I can kind of hold my own if I had to throw hands with someone. But think about it. I'm walking into a federal building in Memphis to go to court and I see masked agents holding automatic weapons. I'm afraid and I've done nothing wrong. Or maybe they'll attack me because I'm counsel and I'm representing these illegals. So if I feel that way, what do you think of 5 foot, 90 pound Guatemalan woman with five kids is going to think when the Green Berets drop from the helicopter and there's sirens like they're going after, the biggest mafioso that's ever lived. And you pull kids out of their apartment in the middle of the night. So I think it's intentional and it's meant to send messages to everybody else who has so far evaded capture that you're going to be next, or you could be next.
That was immigration attorney Andrew Rankin speaking to Pacifica's Thomas O'Rourke about Trump's ICE and Department of Homeland Security legal strategy and DACA and TPS immigration laws. Rankin said that his hometown of Memphis, Tennessee, is expecting a crackdown by Trump's DHS and the Tennessee National Guard. A note for listeners, there is no statute of limitations on misdemeanor or felony immigration violations, according to the 1952 Immigration and Nationality Act or subsequent law, unlike the average 10-year statute of limitation on criminal prosecution for fraud, drug trafficking, and many violent felonies. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective, with contributions from Steve Zeltzer and Thomas O'Rourke. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Paulina Vasiliev. Thanks for listening.